You're listening to the Americans for Truth Hour with your host, Peter LaBarbera. Each week, you'll hear compelling interviews with everyday heroes on the front lines of the culture war. People who put faith and truth above the lies of political correctness. Americans for Truth Hour will help you to stay informed and engaged on the side of life, marriage, and the God-ordained family. Please stand with us as we work to make America, in the words of President Ronald Reagan, a shining city on the hill. And once again, one nation under God. And now, here's Peter LaBarbera.
Well, welcome back, folks, to the Americans for Truth Hour. I'm Pete LaBarbera. Americans for Truth is a single-issue organization devoted to opposing the homosexual activist movement. And we've had a few starts and stops here on the radio schedule, but today we're finishing up part four with Scott Lively, who is a veteran pro-family activist. He is a pastor at Holy Grounds Coffee House in Springfield, Massachusetts. It's known in locally as Coffee House Church. Scott is the author of The Pink Swastika, and he was he's the founder of both Abiding Truth Ministries and Defend the Family International. And Scott was our honoree at Americans for Truth's recent banquet. He received the Americans for Truth American Truth Teller Award for 2011. Welcome back, Scott.
It's good to be back with you, Peter.
Well, you know, it was we had so much yet to talk about, even though we did three full interviews, and we're happy to have you back. First of all, tell us about what's happening. You were targeted again, you and your inner city ministry church, targeted by left-wing activists affiliated with the Occupy movement out there in Springfield, Massachusetts. Tell us what happened.
Yes, I think this is actually the first time that the Occupy movement has actually shifted to the social issues, and so it's sort of a milestone. We had.
So was this Occupy Scott Lively? Is that what this was?
Well, they were marching behind a banner that said Occupy Hate, which I thought was rather appropriate.
Yes, the left occupies hate very well. So.
Yes, they do, and they gathered together. It was a smaller group than actually I was expecting. They only had about 15 or 20 people. Brian Kammacher said two dozen, but I think he was a little generous.
Brian Kammacher is the founder of Massachusetts Mass Resistance, which wrote about your whole event, right? Or the whole protest.
His recent report on that was just excellent. I mean, very, very extensive, lots of photographs. And
you can read that at massresistance.org, folks. That's massresistance.org about this Occupy protest. So, okay, go ahead, Scott.
Yes, well, it actually started Sunday the 13th with a large newspaper ad under the title Stop the Hate. It was a petition signed about 250 people calling on me to apologize for supposed incitement of violence to homosexuals and repeated a number of false charges that have become very common by gay activists around the country.
Now, we talked about some of those in our other interviews, one of them being that you fomented violence in Uganda. So we don't have to go over that, but it's all that same thing where Scott Lively went down to this, spoke at this Uganda conference, and later there was a quote, kill the gays bill, which that, of course, has been distorted. But the whole thing has been distorted because you did not even favor any of the death penalty provisions in that Uganda legislation.
Right. And the more damaging outrageous charge is that the supposed consequence of that supposed incitement to the violence was the murder of David Kato, a prominent Ugandan homosexual activist. But in fact, this man was murdered by a male prostitute whom he took into his house to be his live-in sex partner. And when this man realized he wasn't going to be paid as promised, he bashed the guy's brains in, David Kato's brains in, with a hammer. He was then caught, confessed, and that's now being acknowledged, finally, by the media that this is what has happened. But the gay activists nevertheless continue to promote this false. I mean, what they don't actually come out and say it; they just imply that it was a homophobic hate crime. They just omit the actual facts about the story, and that this was somehow the indirect consequence of my preaching in Uganda. So that was the centerpiece of the allegations that they made in the paper here locally, and that they were chanting about on their when the Occupy Springfield group finally made its way up the hill, you know, beating their 5-gallon plastic drums and chanting at the top of their lungs.
Now let's reiterate here, folks. Here you've got a bill that's controversial in Uganda, although I think its effects are overstated. You have a homosexual activist who is murdered. Turns out he is murdered by his housemate, who's also a homosexual, right, Scott?
Right.
His homosexual housemate has murdered him. Scott Lively, who went down to Uganda before, years ago, and basically gave a pro-family teach-in to Ugandans, is now being blamed not only for the legislation, which he doesn't fully support, and does not support the death penalty provisions, but you're also have been blamed repeatedly over and over again in the media, basically indirectly blamed for the murder of this homosexual activist who turns out was murdered by another homosexual.
Yes. And it's unbelievable. And you can't get the media, you know, whenever this stuff comes up, you can't get the liberals in the media to do any correction on these points. They don't do any fact checking. They don't correct people making these allegations. They let them, lie so that they can damage my credibility. Because that's the whole point of this.
Yes.
So
all about demonizing Scott Lively. Okay, so now you've got the protest. Based on the ad, then what happened? Some local left-wing organizations sort of went together on this thing, or how did that happen?
Well, I think that it's a local ACORN affiliate called Arise for Social Justice is the real culprit behind this. They have been, they're only three doors away from us. That's really kind of funny. Our Holy Grounds Coffee House, our little inner city mission church, is three doors away from their office, and this is it's a local ACORN affiliate. It's very low end. Now the posters and stuff they have in the windows look like they're something done by grammar school students. It's really kind of embarrassing, but nevertheless, they've been there for a very long time. They're Marxist in their inspiration, and they decided to take us on, and actually the one of the leaders there told my building superintendent, who went over and challenged them. They didn't put their name on this ad when they ran it, so he went over there and basically asked them if they're the ones who did it. They did admit it. They said that they weren't going to stop any of this until they drive Scott Lively out of Springfield. And so we focused our attention on Arise when this Occupy Springfield. It's the same people. That's what the leftists have always done. They just have any number of different titles that they use for themselves, but it's the same group of people. But they've teamed up also with a quote unquote gay student group. I think based in the high school.
Okay.
I don't know if it's at the community college or at the high school, but that's the people who are behind both the petition and the protest.
And so they came down to your coffee house, and what did they do? Chant outside the window?
Well, they came. Well, they gathered down the hill about five or six blocks away, and they came marching up with this, you know, big banner, which is really just drawn on a sheet, on a bed sheet, and they were it's so funny. And they're pounding. They've got
this is makeshift
funny.
Leftism, huh? This is really you didn't even merit the high glossy leftism, Scott. I mean,
on. It's bad. These are the kind of protesters I get. Anyway, they've got the standard stuff. You know, we're here, we're queer, get used to it, and all these other sorts of things, and some specific anti Scott Lively signs and whatnot. But so they came up and they were very surprised when they saw us, because we had more than twice the people there. In fact, it was a local Tea Party leader that found out that they were going to protest us, because I guess the Tea Party monitors the the Facebook pages of some of these people. And so I got an email saying, hey, they're going to protest you. Are you going to have a counter protest? Because if you are, we want to be there. And so I sort of considered it and prayed about it and decided, well, my 3.5 year policy of ignoring the harassment should end at this point.
You basically ignored the homosexual issue, what you were best known for. You did not make that an issue locally there in Springfield, correct?
Right. That's right. Well, our purpose here is to do something completely different. We're creating a model for re-Christianizing a post-Christian city. My wife and I moved into an abandoned house in the middle of the worst neighborhood in the inner city and started renovating it. We bought this building that we've converted into Holy Grounds Coffee House, and we work with the most disadvantaged of the people in this very downtrodden city. And I knew from the beginning that if I, you know, address the homosexual issue here, you know, we're only like 15, 20 miles south of Northampton, which is the lesbian capital of the world. We're surrounded by, you know, hardcore leftists in this state. Massachusetts is the most morally corrupt state in the union. I knew if I addressed the issue here, that's all I would ever do, and we wouldn't be able to engage in the kind of ministry that we're doing. But now it's been 3.5 years. Look, the foundation's been laid. We have a good, solid infrastructure for the mission, leaders that have arisen, and it doesn't even need my direct supervision anymore. So I think the Lord is basically saying, okay, it's now time to start to addressing this, because it's something that does need to be addressed here in Massachusetts.
Okay,
obviously.
Scott, we'll have to hold you off there. We're talking to Scott Lively. He's the founder of Defend the Family International. You can find that at defendthefamily.com. I'll be right back. Welcome back to the Americans for Truth Hour. We're talking to our good friend Scott Lively, who is the recipient of the Americans for Truth Truth Teller Award for 2011. Scott has done yeoman's work on the homosexual issue and other family issues, and he's taken a heck of a lot of heat and abuse and lies from the left. We went over some of those in our previous interviews. He addressed those at our banquet that happened in October 2011. Last month, and Scott is just, I mean, I think, Scott, you could write a very thick book just trying to correct some of the lies. I mean, it was fascinating. I said this at the banquet. You spoke twice at the banquet. It was fascinating just hearing you recollect these awful lies that were told about you and these awful court cases and this legal harassment, and you, and just hearing you correct that story really compelled, you know, it moved me to want to. I really think our movement needs a history of the homosexual struggle, not told by a homosexual activist.
Yes, and you know, that's one of the reasons why there are so very few, you know, pro-family activists in the country, is because these guys are absolutely relentless in trying to drive people out of a position of opposing them.
Yes.
Anybody. And like I like to use the example of Carrie Prejean, who was the beautiful girl that that won the or was in contestant four or won the Miss Universe, Donald Trump's beauty pageant. You remember that story?
Yeah, it was Miss America. Yeah, I can't remember which one. Yeah, okay. She's a beauty pageant who said, who affirmed her support, her opposition to gay marriage.
Yeah, well, she was asked the question. She was basically set up for this question by a homosexual on the judging panel.
Yes.
Who basically hit her with this, you know, gotcha question about her stand on gay marriage, and really putting her on the spot, believing that she was going to sort of give the politically correct answer, because that's, and that would have been a coup for him. And but instead, she stayed true to her Lord and her biblical worldview, and she just said, you know, I believe marriage is between a man and a woman. Just that simple statement. And then she ended up suffering weeks and weeks of blistering attacks and all kinds of, it was a national news story for a while. But the point I'd like to make is that, you know, that's an example of the kind of viciousness and vitriol that people have to face who stand up to this. And if they could do that to that girl, if we're doing nothing other than just simply making the simplest, most innocuous statement in defense of her own religious values, then imagine what they do with other people like myself, others who have stood up, who don't have public scrutiny, sort of protecting us from harassment.
Exactly. And it's interesting how they constantly ratchet it up. Now, what I would like to chronicle with you is, I mean, the multiple lies. Anybody who's met you, Scott, knows you're not a mean person. you're a very kind-hearted Christian man who's obviously you've taken your love of the Lord to an inner city ministry, which very, very few people, very, very few Christians would do, and I commend you for it. It's wonderful, and yet somehow the image they've tried to conjure up of you is some awful, hate monger, and it's just so preposterous. But this is the way they operate. They've done it to me. They've done it to Brian Kamiker. They've done it to Bob Knight. They've done it to Gary Glenn. Anybody who stands up, we're simply
Linda Harvey too recently.
Linda Harvey,
they're going after her.
Of course, Linda Harvey has been terribly lied about, and yet the importance for us is that the truth still must be affirmed. And so you've made the decision now that you've been protested, you're not going to avoid the homosexual, although you're still not going to make it the major issue out there, I'm sure, in Springfield,
right.
But I mean, you're not going to just avoid it.
Right. At this point, I actually think that it will help in the process of the re-Christianization of the city, because we really now that the mission is strong and everything is in place and doesn't require my attention, I can deal with some of these other issues. And this is Massachusetts.
Yeah.
People need, Christians need symbols and leaders that they can look to, that we're going to stand solidly for the truth, that are not going to back down. And that's what I represent here in Springfield. I'm doing something that no one else here dares to do. I'm doing it unapologetically, but with a, with good humor and in a good-natured way. And that's a very powerful thing.
Now, Scott, let's transition here, because we never and we managed somehow in our, and this is our fourth interview, to not really go into your thing that you're best known for, which is the Pink Swastika. What's the full title of that book, Paul, Scott?
It's the Pink Swastika: Homosexuality in the Nazi Party.
Okay, now tell us, we've got 6 minutes till the break. Tell us what inspired you to write this book?
Well, once again, this was a response to attacks by homosexuals. I was the communications director of the Oregon Citizens Alliance in Oregon back in 1991 when we were running a ballot measure for the 92 election cycle. And the opposition ran their campaign against us on the theme that people who oppose gay rights are like Nazis. And in the course of that campaign, A professional researcher came by and dropped off a sheet of papers at my office that documented the homosexuality of many of the Nazi elite. And out of that came a book. I did hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of additional hours to dig up everything I could find. In fact, I have a whole file cabinet right now in preparation for doing a fifth edition of the book. But, we have now in the fourth edition 400 pages of documentation about the homosexuality of the Nazis and the fact that the Nazi Party was really an outgrowth of the German gay subculture. And it sounds outrageous to anyone who believes sort of the common, the wisdom of the Nazi era. But it's very solidly documented, with based upon mainstream historians, leading historians of that era, and at least 25% of the sources are from gay historians and scholars.
Well, people who've read The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich?
Yes.
Who's the author of that?
Shirer.
Shire. I'm here with John McCartney, who's
William
a
volunteer.
I forgot to mention I've got John McCartney here, who's a great volunteer for Americans for Truth. William Shire, you know, Shire documented that he called them, I believe he called them sexual perverts, didn't he, Scott?
Yes.
He documented that sexual perverts were rampant, you know, rife in the Nazi movement, which you would suspect. I mean, these are the brown shirts. And, of course, the brown shirts were led by a notorious flagrant homosexual. Is that his name was Ernst Röhm, correct?
That's right. Ernst Röhm was recruited into homosexuality by the creator of the brown shirts, whose name was Gerhard Rauschenbach. You know, the entire early brown shirts was a homosexual organization at the beginning.
That's astonishing, because everybody thinks of the brown shirts as sort of the symbol. It's become a modern day symbol for thuggery, political thuggery, tyranny, and here the brown shirts had a heavy homosexual component.
Well, it's the same as it was. It's the same now as it was then.
Yeah,
the people that are engaging in the thuggery are as homosexual now as they were then.
Yeah, we see the thuggery, and of course, you know, just to reiterate, folks, if you didn't go back to the early interviews, which are available at AmericansForTruth.org, when Scott came to visit, and because Scott Lively was being honored by Americans for Truth, the night before our banquet, actually the early morning of the same day of our banquet, October 15th, homosexuals threw two large bricks through the window of the building hosting the church, the Christian school hosting our banquet, and the message was shut down Lively.
Yeah.
Another notch on your belt there, Scott.
Yes, you know, this is what I have endured for a very long time. You know, and it's worse actually here in Massachusetts. Ryan Sorba, who's been still working on his book, The Born Gay Hoax, tried to give a lecture on that at Smith College in Northampton, which I said is the lesbian capital of the world. They rioted, smashed out the windows, came rushing into the hall, and basically closed down the event. And Don Fetter, who is a highly respected intellectual conservative Jew, tried to give a talk on the demographic winter, which has implications for homosexuality, and he was shouted down, not allowed to give his talk at UMass. And so, you know, this is the kind of stuff that the brown shirts did. Yeah. And it's the same people now as it was then. It's homosexual political activists.
Were you, slowly, so we got about a minute and a half left before the break. Were you surprised when you started reading this? I mean, did you have any inkling before of this nature?
When I first got these notes, I actually put them in a file, didn't even really look at them carefully because I thought the guy was just a nut. I believe my job was to differentiate the Nazis' hate-based opposition to homosexuality from the Christian morality-based opposition. And I believe that the Nazis really had persecuted homosexuals and that there was, you know, something equivalent to a gay Holocaust that had happened.
They did persecute effeminate homosexuals, is what you write in the book, right?
Right. There was a relatively small number of effeminate male homosexuals who were mistreated by the Nazis. And the Nazis' official policy was very harshly anti-homosexual. But that was a cover for Hitler and his inner circle, who were masculine-oriented homosexuals who couldn't allow the public to know about their inclinations. They never would have stood for it. The Weimar government, the Weimar period, was extremely libertine. And the Nazis came up suggesting that they were going to provide a new moral order in which this sort of these excesses would be stopped. And so they couldn't very well allow the public to know what they were doing in their private lives.
Right, right. Okay, well, we're talking to Scott Lively, who's the author of The Pink Swastika. We'll be right back after the break. Thank you.
Are you sick and tired of homosexuality and gay marriage being celebrated by the liberal media and popular culture? Do you worry about the radical gay agenda being pushed on young children in schools? Are you worried that the gay movement will destroy America's religious freedoms? And are you offended that Christians are called bigots and homophobes just because they agree with God that homosexual behavior is wrong? Americans for Truth About Homosexuality is a single-issue group devoted to exposing and fighting the gay agenda. They are not about hate, but love for God's truth. They are Christians, so instead of celebrating homosexuality, they lift up the many ex-gays who have left it behind and now lead godly lives through Christ. But Americans for Truth needs your help. The gay lobby has lots of money, power, and media support, but it lacks truth. Please help keep this show on the air and educate America about the dangerous goals of this anti-Christian movement. Make your gift online today at AmericansForTruth.com. That's AmericansForTruth.com.
Welcome back, folks, to the Americans for Truth Hour. We're talking to Scott Lively, who is a pro-family icon. We're talking about all the abuse that he's taken over the years for standing, just telling the truth about homosexuality. And Scott, as I said, you're best known for the pink swastika, which took a lot of guts to write, of course. Could you give us give a rundown of some of the Nazi leadership that had a perversion problem beside Ernst Röhm?
Well, yes, the inner circle around Hitler was almost all homosexual, especially in the early years, but even later.
Did Ernst Röhm recruit Hitler into the Nazi movement, or did he discover Hitler? I thought I read somewhere where he sort of discovered Hitler.
Well, they were running in the same circles, and Ernst Röhm was the power broker and the power behind the throne in the early days of the Nazi Party. It wasn't Adolf Hitler.
He was he was the head of the stormtroopers. So,
right.
So these were the Nazi bullies, right?
That's right. And Röhm had been a captain in the German army, and Hitler had only been a corporal. And Ernst Röhm is the one who had all the contacts with the military-industrial leaders. See, at the end of World War One, the Treaty of Versailles had imposed very strict limitations on what Germany could do militarily. And 100,000 men in arms was the limit. And, of course, the German military, which has always been a very powerful force, was required to disband down to that 100,000 limit. So what the nationalists did is they, in order to sort of maintain, some semblance of what they had before, they created a bunch of pseudo-military or paramilitary or, faux military organizations that they put all these men in. And there's a number of groups called Freikorps that were, which means free corps. Free, meaning that they're not connected with the national military. They were under the control of the former junior officers of the army. And one of these Freikorps was called the Rossbachbund. It was headed by Gerhard Rossbach, who was the homosexual that recruited Ernst Röhm into homosexuality. And all of the members of the Rossbachbund were homosexual. It was a homosexual Freikorps.
How big are we talking about? How big did this get?
It wasn't in the hundreds. It's sort of sketchy as to exactly how many people there were, but it wasn't a huge. These were small units. The nationalists were attempting to keep the military together. And and they had weapons cached and other things like that. They were always hoping that the time would come when they would be able to restore their military power. But anyway, the Rossbach organization was distinct from all the others because of the uniforms that he had his men wear. All the others were wearing the same uniforms they had worn in World War One, for gray military uniforms. But Rossbach had gone to the army surplus stores and had gotten brown uniforms that were left over from Germany's lost African colonies. Because World War One, they were booted out of Africa. And so the surplus stores were filled with these, brown uniforms. So these Rossbach troopers wore these brown shirts, and that's how they got their name of brown shirts. And they were distinct from all the others. So all of the brown shirts, all of the early Abteilung, stormtroopers, were part of this homosexual group. Now, later, the brown shirts expanded to something like 3 million men. And, of course, by that point, the percentage of homosexuals was probably not that great. But they were leaders because they were the originals. So they were the, you know, heading up the large units and et cetera. Anyway, that's Ernst Röhm and his involvement. We also had around Hitler Rudolf Hess, who was a homosexual. He was known in as they called him Black Bertha. The Soviets called him Black Bertha, and he was called in Germany Fräulein Anna as his nickname. There was also
was he a crossdresser?
No, actually, he wasn't. That was Goering. Goering was a crossdresser.
So you've got all this deviance in the Nazi hierarchy. I mean, how do you explain it? Is it just because it was how do you explain the predominance of this within the Nazis?
Well, in the 1850s or so, I forget the actual starting date, the so-called higher criticism movement arose in Germany. It was an attack on the authority of the Bible. Germany had been a very solid Christian country, and then all of a sudden it became the most liberal country in the world, theologically. And that higher criticism movement attacked the authority of the Bible, said that the miracles of the Bible were myths. And it opened the door to a rapid disintegration of the German moral order, and occultism began to really grow rapidly at the same time. So you had the Blavatsky, Helena Petrovna Blavatsky, and her Theosophical Society, sort of swooping in and inspiring all of these sort of German nutcases to follow her, bizarre occultic fantasies.
So you had a lot of occultism that sort of filled the void of where a more traditional Christianity once was?
Yes. And then concurrently, you have the disintegration of the moral order, especially regarding sexuality. And they were hand in hand. The primary German occultists were also homosexuals. So you had people like Jörg Lanz von Liebenfels, who was called the man who gave Hitler his ideas. This is a guy who was flying the swastika flag above his castle in 1907, right? Many years before the Nazi Party was even formed. And he published a magazine called Astara, which Astara is the German variant of Ashtaroth, the mother goddess, and is the female counterpart to Wotan, which is where they get the term stormtroopers. Wotan is the god of the storms. So you had Wotan and Astara, who are the same as Baal and Ashtaroth. And Jörg Lanz von Liebenfels published this magazine, which was Hitler's favorite magazine. And many of the ideas that Hitler would later adopt and embrace came directly from this man and straight out of the German occultic movement.
Was the occultic forces, they centered around German nationalism, many of them? And
yes, yeah. As a matter of fact, it was von Liebenfels and then another fellow, Guido von List, who was a specialist in the power of runes. And
runes, what are runes?
Runes are the Teutonic alphabet.
Right.
They're ancient symbols. That's what the lightning bolt S that was used by the SS, that was a rune.
Hmm.
And when you see the parades, especially in the earlier years of the Nazi Party, maybe the mid-30s, there were a lot of parades with these runic banners. And the SS also required all the people who joined it to change their name from Christian names to Teutonic names and occultic names. The movie Raiders of the Lost Ark, you know, Steven Spielberg's, mm-hmm. you know, sort of blockbuster fantasy, is actually based on a, I mean, the story itself is fanciful, but the core of the idea is true. The Germans actually were seeking all over the world these occult relics that were said to exist. You know, the Spear of Destiny, which is supposedly the spear that pierced Christ's side. Mm-hmm. You know, they actually were looking for those things. And so there was this tremendous amount of occultism. Well, von Liebenfels and Guido von Liszt formed an organization called the Armanen Order. And it was like a priesthood of occultic masters. And it had chapters all over Germany. And the Bavarian chapter of the Armanen Order changed its name to the Thule Society in, I think, 1918. As a result to attempt to hide from the scrutiny that was being was coming as a result of the murders of members of the Weimar government. See, the nationalists, many of them connected with this Armanen Order, were assassinating these what they called the November criminals. You know, the people signed this treaty and negotiated this treaty of Versailles that the nationalists considered a great bit of treason. And so they were killing all these guys off. Well, the government then started going after the assassins. And so the Bavarian chapter of the Armanen Order changed its name to sort of hide. And then it was this group, the Thule Society, that was the new name, was the group that then decided they were going to work through legitimate political means. And so they started looking about for a political party to take over. And they found a party called the German Workers' Party. And that was the party that they then sent in Hitler and Ernst Röhm to investigate. They then took it over and then turned it into the National Socialist German Workers' Party, the Nazis.
Let's leave it at that. We're talking to Scott Lively, who's the author of The Pink Swastika. His website is, one of his websites is defendthefamily.com. We'll be right back. Hello, folks. We're on our final segment with Scott Lively, the fourth part of a four-part interview. You can go to the other parts at AmericansForTruth.org. And, Scott, I'm reminded talking to you of I once approached a conservative, I believe it was a Dartmouth German historian, and I asked him about the whole question of the homosexuality in the Nazi party. And I can't recall his name right now, but he was a known conservative. He said that the people on campus used to ask him if he would give a talk about the gay victims of the Nazis. And he said, I'll do that as long as you also let me talk about the gay Nazis themselves. So this is an aspect which, of course, has been largely forgotten or ignored in history. Your research has helped bring out a popular history for mostly conservatives about the fact that there was a lot of sexual deviance at the highest realm of the Nazi Party. And why is that relevant?
Well, I mean, if we're coming from a biblical worldview and you read the book of Romans, the Bible has described what the reprobate mind looks like, and has identified it with people who self-identify as homosexuals.
Yeah.
And what the Pink Swastika is documenting is essentially historical evidence of what the Bible warns against.
Yeah.
That there's something about this phenomenon of sexual perversion that opens the door to all kinds of evil. And how could people do the things that the Nazis did?
Yeah.
You know, how could they burn people, you know, vast numbers of people, just burn them alive in ovens or gas them in gas chambers, you know, solely because they were of a different race?
Yeah.
It really wasn't just because they were of a different race. It actually, the Nazis hated the Jews because of their moral position. Their biblical moral position, because the Jews, Orthodox Jews, share the exact same view as Christians, because our source is the same regarding those things. But you know, This isn't a condemnation of every person who struggles with same-sex attraction, mm-hmm. because clearly that wouldn't be the case. But there's just something about this phenomenon of sexual perversion that caused God to define it as tueva, which is abomination. That's the word. It's the Hebrew word. It means abomination. It means a detestable thing. And God does not state things lightly.
I don't think we even have an appreciation, even in America today, of the evil of organized homosexuality. I think people like us, we try to convey what we can, but I've always found that when you actually tell the worst of it, you get a lot of people are incredulous or they just can't, they almost can't even listen to it. A classic example would be some of the actual perversions themselves, some of the actual practices that especially men, homosexual men practice. They are so revolting. They're so depraved that even to discuss them almost brings
shameful even to talk about some of the things that are done in secret. That's another thing that the scripture says.
Yeah. It makes sense, obviously, that a deviant party, a deviant political movement, which is what the Nazis were, I mean, that probably one of the most deviant ever, with the mass killing of Jews, it would make sense to us who believe the Bible that there would be other deviancies and including sexual deviancies that would be highly associated with it. Just as today, it would make sense that there would be a higher association between homosexuality and, say, pedophilia and other perversions, and in fact, that's what we see.
Well, you know, the devil seeks to rob, kill, and destroy. His purpose is to degrade people, and when anyone opens the door to any sin, it basically, they begin a process of degeneration, of falling away, or being pulled away from the pursuit of the image of God into the desires and appetites of the flesh and indulging them. And that path has no bottom. There's no bottom to that pit. Mm-hmm. A person becomes more and more and more depraved over time. That's what the Bible calls a reprobate mind. And there's a reason that it's identified with homosexuality in Scripture, because it's the outer edge of the categories of sexual deviance that are identified in the Scripture. There is a standard. Now, deviance can only be measured by a standard. The standard is the natural family of one man and one woman joined together as one flesh, as defined in Genesis, and therefore shall a man leave his father and his mother and cleave unto his wife, and they'll become one flesh. That natural family is protected by the institution called marriage that is like a cocoon that surrounds and protects it from its worst enemy, which is sexual promiscuity. The idea of sexual freedom is the worst enemy of the natural family. And people who have defined themselves as homosexuals are people who are living inside of a body created by God as either male or female to be the complementary partner of someone of the opposite sex. And despite the evidence of the creation, of the part of the creation that they actually dwell within, they deny that truth and identify themselves based on a desire to engage in conduct that repudiates God's design.
Mm-hmm. But yet, it's amazing. It's amazing the sort of spin, the shiny veneer that's put on that. You know, just the word "gay" itself is such a simplistic reduction of something that is, as you say, is incredibly wrong, and yet it's so trivialized today.
Well, and it also, this whole perspective explains why the extreme moral degradation is associated with people who identify with a homosexual identity. You know, once you have abandoned the simple reality of the purpose for your life, physiologically, to mate with someone of the opposite sex, once you've abandoned that and have rejected the authority of God in your life over that aspect of reality, then it's much easier to simply be swept up into every other kind of falsehood.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the tragedy of the homosexual self-identity.
Yeah.
And that's the story of how people who were living in Germany could fall into a culture that would end up doing the things that they did. They went down that slippery slope of abandoning the truth of God about sexuality and plunged into depravity to an extreme that it's hard for people who haven't seen it to understand.
Yeah. Now, you got a minute left, Scott, here to the break. Many critics of your work, and they say, oh, Scott Lively's blaming the Holocaust on gays. That's usually
absolutely
the sort
not.
Of absurd reductionism that we see from our opponents. Answer that in 45 seconds.
Well, the pink swastika affirms the documentation of the existence of a Holocaust of the Jews. It denies the mythology of a gay Holocaust. Which is
that millions and millions of gays were killed like Jews, and or some awful approximation of that
right.
of the Jewish actual, the real Holocaust. Yeah.
And we have a chart in the book that shows the side by side what actually happened to the Jews. You know, 6 million people killed by the Nazis versus 5,000 to 15,000 homosexuals who were killed and who were not killed in death camps. They were killed. You know, they died as a result of overwork in slave camps, things like that. It certainly wasn't.
We'll have to leave it there, Scott, but we thank you for being in the interview, and we thank you so much for all your work. God bless. And we'll be back next time with Americans for Truth Hour. Thank you.
This was the Americans for Truth Hour with your host, Peter LaBarbera. Tune in Saturdays at 11 p.m. to hear compelling interviews with everyday heroes on the front lines of the culture war. People who put faith and truth above the lies of political correctness. Stay informed and engaged on the issues of life, marriage, and the God-ordained family. Please stand with them as they work to make America, in the words of President Ronald Reagan, a shining city on the hill. And once again, one nation under God. The Americans for Truth Hour, Saturdays at 11 p.m. on AM 1160.